Well, so that everyone will know what's going on in this studio, my name is Bill Andrews, and I'm an employee of the National Broadcasting Company, KNBC, but I'm here purposely to talk to an interview and rehash old times with two wonderful people, and so that their voices may become identified, I'll ask first for the voice of Carlton Morse. How are you, Carlton?
I'm fine, Bill. What do you mean, only here? As a matter of fact, you began, you were the first announcer for the first program I ever did for NBC in 1929. A pretty important personality in my life. And, of course, next to me here is Mike Raffetto, who is known as Paul, a one-man's family, and for many other things that he wrote and acted in through the years of NBC. Mike?
Well, we're here. We've reached the age now, I suppose, where we're called back to reminisce. And this is always a pleasant thing to do. And I made a couple of notes about things that used to go on in 1930. And I remember one thing in particular. We always had to dress in dress clothes after 8 o'clock. All programs all had to be in dress clothes. And so we'd leave this dinner jacket up in the mezzanine, and all the actors would come in and get into a dirty dress shirt. It was almost black, but it met the requirement. And then, in those days, the sound effects, we had a boy, a sound effects boy.
He wasn't a sound effects man, he was a sound effects boy.
He was a boy, and he usually missed cues, and so all the actors had to help out with sound effects. So I can remember we'd do a Western. If you weren't actually speaking, then you'd get down with half coconuts on the floor in dress clothes, making the horse ride in, you know?
The horse's hooves.
The horse's
with coconut shells.
Coconut shells, yeah. That's one of my reminiscences. And then, well, I'll pause and let somebody else talk, and then I'll come up with something else.
Carlton?
I started to work for NBC in September of 1929, the same month as the crash. The stock market crash. One of my friends... who came to work about the same time, Dresser Dolstead, now a producer in Hollywood, came to work, was hired the day or a week before the crash, and came to work the Monday after the crash, and received a cut on his first day of work. But, during those days, the thing that was so very pleasant was there was no standards of writing, or you were turned loose and think of something and do it. And out of these things, this maelstrom of confusion came so many of the shows that later developed into coast and national shows. But this this turmoil, everybody with an idea, working, it was a wonderful time. It was the new era of in a new medium, and everybody had his opportunity.
Another way of saying it, Carlton and Mike, is that every step that we took, every time we put our feet forward and opened our mouths on the microphone, every time you hit that typewriter in preparing these plays and writing these scripts, we were exploring the unknown, literally. Is
right.
That true?
It certainly was true. And sometimes the bottom dropped out of things, and chaos took place. We had one director who was so inept that he never could time a script right. So in the middle of a show, He would come in to the actors who were on the air with their pages of script, and he would thumb through the scripts in front of their mind and point to a line for somebody to pick up out of the empty air. And this was how he cut scripts on the air. You remember that, Mike?
Yes, I remember him very well. And to cover himself, of course, he was usually a little drunk. And to cover up, I'd look in, he would give a hurry-up signal and a slow-down signal in tandem so that he was safe. So he gave both signals, and it was the actor's fault if we didn't get off.
Right. Do you remember a very fine old gentleman, an actor, who came very often into the studio a little bit high, and sitting in the booth, I could always tell where Charlie was in his cups. Because if he tried to pretend that everything was all right, so he would read a line and then he would run up and look in the booth to see if everything was, if it nodded, everything's fine, and he would do this during the whole show. Then you knew you were going to get a bad performance out of Charlie.
Waiting for the nod of approval.
That's right.
You know, I think we should say a word too about the importance of this area, that is Northern California and San Francisco, to the whole story and life of radio, because, believe it or not, in those days, there did not exist a transcontinental network. And here in San Francisco, we duplicated everything that was done originally in New York. As a matter of fact, there was no such thing as airmail. And so the scripts would be performed in New York with New York casts, orchestras, and directions. And these would then be sent by train to San Francisco. And we, in turn, would pick up some of this stuff and repeat it for the Pacific Coast Network, because the network transcontinentally did not exist at that time.
This, until we got tired of doing that and did our own.
We did our own, that's right. And it was Carlton who established himself as one of the great radio dramatists of all times right here in San Francisco, with the assistance of cast and actors such as Mike, who is across the mic from me right now. Mike, how do you want to comment on that?
Well, of course, it was Carlton's writing that gave us a certain amount of fame and some security, because in the early days before the family, it was not unusual to get $5 for a performance, and I can remember we were all under contract, subject to how many calls we'd get in. It was with great excitement and anxiety that we'd get our casting sheet each week and open it up to see how many programs we had. And with some of them, of course, this was in 1930 and 31, in the midst of the Depression. And so it was with great anxiety that we opened this envelope to see how many programs we had. And very often, we didn't have enough to make ends meet, and we would go to Daly City to try to help out the income at a gambling place. And that often...
Mike, those existed at that time.
Yes, they existed. This was during Prohibition, and this is 30 years ago, so I'm sure it's all now pure. But we would go down and gamble, and I remember Bart and I, many times coming out, the man would give us carfare back, and we'd get on the trolley car. And I remember dear old Bart saying, as we got on the trolley car one night, he had a little child, and said, "I don't think I'll be able to pay the baby this week."
And, excuse me, when they come back, then each of us would sign the other's Morris Plan notes, and that's the way we'd live from week to week. Actually, there's an institution that we probably founded and supported for many years. We should be at least part owners, which unfortunately we are not.
I think we could comment too on that matter of income. In those days, $27 a week or $25 a week was rather a magnificent sum, wasn't it, Mike? Sometimes it was as little as $9 a week.
Yes, of course, it's so relative, but we were happy to get $10 for a performance, and this was a handsome fee.
Now, you mentioned Bart in your conversation just a moment ago. That I know you were referring to Barton Yarborough, who played Cliff on One Man's Family.
Yeah. Yes, and we lost Bart in 1951. And
also in those days, the referring again to the pioneering that was done, we had a staff of artists and musicians. By artists, I mean singers, actors, actresses, musicians, conductors, producers, writers. That was, I would estimate it was probably 225 to 250 in number, wasn't it, Carlton?
I would think so. I know the halls at 111 Sutter were cluttered with humanity from early in the morning until midnight, and everybody seemed to be busy. Studios were crowded. It was a fabulous era for radio. It opened a whole new vista of program ideas and personalities.
There was such a hard rule against. There was no such thing as a recording, even for a sound effect. You remember that, Bill?
Indeed, indeed.
Every sound effect had to be done manually, and there was no canned. Nothing could be done by way of a record.
Well, actually, Mike, they didn't, when we started, they didn't have
exist.
Recordings. We had no such things as recording a program. I mean, all the early shows of One Man's Family were completely lost because there was no way of recording them. They were just starting in those days to...
Let's see if we can remember some of the methods and means of simulating sound effects. For example, Mike a moment ago mentioned the coconut shells on the floor for horses' hoofs galloping across the plains and whatnot. I recall whenever there was a scene in the snow and people were walking through heavy crusted snow, we'd use a tiny bag of cornstarch, a cloth bag of cornstarch, put it close to the microphone and we'd twist it and it'd go squeak, squeak, just like snow walking on snow. Yeah. What about fire in the fireplace or whatever, or frying eggs? How did you fry an egg in those days on the air?
They fried an egg. but I was thinking for one time we wanted a waterfall, and we took the mic into the men's room and turned on the faucets in the basin and put the mic close
enough.
Up and got the mic wet and
a veritable Niagara
and got into trouble with the engineering department. you used all sorts of your own ingenuity, and according to the later sound effects, I suppose it had been pretty bad. But everything was so new, and everything was accepted so wholeheartedly. That this is the terrible thing that I regret is that the public has lost its naivete. It has become sophisticated to the point where it wants not entertainment, but perfection, to a point where new ideas are not as important.
Well, here we've been talking, Carlton Morris, author, radio dramatist, original author of One Man's Family, director, producer of the program, and Mike Raffetto, who played that wonderful part, Paul. My name is Bill Andrews. I'm still at NBC. And we've done all of this as part of the KNBC KPO 40th anniversary, 40 years. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Congratulations to KPO.
Congratulations to KPO.
And to KNBC.
And to KNBC.
Well, it's a great week here in San Francisco, celebrating the 40th anniversary of KPO, now KNBC. And before the microphone, we have two gentlemen of considerable merit and accomplishment, Carlton Morris, author of One Man's Family, and Mike Raffetto, who played Paul in that great show. Carlton, let's talk for a while about the present-day location, perhaps, of the cast, the original cast of One Man's Family. Do you or do you, Mike, know where they might be, or?
Before you get into that, though, let's identify Bill Andrews, who is introducing us, who was our announcer 30 years ago when we all began in this field.
Thanks very much, Carl. Michael Raffetto himself.
Yes, well, you were asking where the people were now that played in the show, and as you know, Carlton wrote it with the original cast of seven people. And Father Barber, Tony Smythe, is living in Los Angeles, ageless as usual. He was always ageless. Still
a little dowdy.
Yes, a bit gouty, but doughty.
A confirmed bachelor.
A confirmed bachelor.
In private life.
In private life, quite right. And Minetta Ellen, who played Mother Barber, is living in Glendale in California. She's still active and 86 years old.
That's what I wanted to know. She's 86 years old and going like a fireball, I'll bet.
That's true.
Good. Go ahead, Mike.
And I'm taking these in the order and age in the show, not necessarily chronologically. And I recently moved up from Los Angeles and I'm living in Berkeley. And Bernice Berwin, who is Mrs. Brooks Berlin, lives in Oakland.
She played
Hazel.
Yes, sir.
The original Claudia now lives, that was Kathleen Wilson, now lives in New York City and is mother of several children. And Barton Yarborough, who played Clifford, her twin, died in 1951 while the family was still going on in Hollywood. And Paige Gilman, who played Jack, the youngest brother, is working on a newspaper and living with his wife and three children in Ojai, in California. So we've only lost one of the original seven.
Yeah, that's
remarkable.
Yes. And right here, I would like to say, as the writer and producer of the show, that I am so grateful to have had such a wonderfully loyal group of people. Can you imagine seven people and we lost nobody over a period of 25 years? And that is a very extraordinary thing and shows the caliber of people that made up the family.
It occurs to me that there are perhaps many people listening at this moment who have fond and wonderful memories of One Man's Family. Do you suppose that in the time that has elapsed that there are listeners hearing us at this moment who don't know what One Man's Family was? Do you suppose that's possible, Mike? They'd be very young, though, wouldn't they?
I heard a statement this morning right here in these studios. NBC is putting on some radio drama in the evening, and they have gotten something like 600-700 letters from young people who had never heard radio or drama on radio and feel like they had discovered something new. In other words, a new generation is coming along who don't know what radio drama is, so certainly they wouldn't know what One Man's Family was. This, I think, is the future of radio.
That reminds me of the introduction that we used to use at each episode. It went something like this. See if I have it.
Mm-hmm.
One Man's Family is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring.
Good, Bill, you remember. It's wonderful.
Tonight we present, what would it be, about chapter 40, no, book 40, chapter 500.
Yeah.
KPO's 40th anniversary.
Right. As a matter of fact, when One Man's Family finally closed, it was book 189, and these were book lengths. Each one of these books was book length 100,000 word novel, 80 to 100,000 word novel. which means that we got up into the many millions of words that were written and spoken over the air in the name of one man's family.
I remember the little cubicle that Carlton had on the 21st floor of the what was originally the Hunter Doolin building and then became 111 Sutter. And the writers and producers were on the 21st floor, and the writers didn't have an office. They had a cubicle. And Carlton would get in very early in the morning. He would get up at 5 o'clock, and he'd be in there before anybody else, pounding that typewriter, getting out another episode. And I remembered, are we running out of time?
Oh, we're doing very well. We're about 6 minutes, 15 seconds into this one, Mike.
Oh, I'm so time conscious.
Oh, boy. That's radio.
Yeah. I remember after we moved south in 1937, wasn't it, Carl?
1937, almost.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
We moved the family out of San Francisco, which was a sad day for all of us because we dreaded to leave this beautiful city. And I got out of the southern part of the state back here as soon as I possibly could. Well, as you get older, you proceed on a sort of broad parenthetical front. What was I talking about? We got south, and of course, pictures became interested in it, and we made tests and everything, and it never got into pictures, but I remember once Carlton, they sent a writer around to Carlton, and they were thinking about making a scenario for One Man Family, and they said, have you got any material? And Carlton had all these bound volumes of One Man Family, filled a whole bookshelf, and he said, well, there it is.
And they went away from there and never came back.
It was too big a bite to chew, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, it was a wonderful 5 years of the show here in San Francisco before we went south. And the show started with three scripts. I took into Don Gilman, and this came out of as a direct result of I had been doing the Captain Post crime series,
House of Myths.
House of Myths, but I was thinking more in the police
Chinatown Squad.
Police Quinn series, the original Dragnet.
And these were the type of shows that. Very soon, everybody was doing everything was bang bang, kill 'em and so forth. And I wanted to get as far away as I could from this
brutality.
Yes, it was this wildness.
The grim.
And I had in the back of my mind always. Wanting to do a family show. I was in love with John Galsworthy's English Families, Forsyte Saga, and so forth. And the psychiatrist said that I had a yearning to build the perfect family for myself, which I think we did a pretty good job doing.
Millions of people agree with that statement.
So that is how I wrote three scripts and took them in and laid them on Don Gilman, who was the vice president of the West Coast in those days. And in a due time, they came back, and he said, well, could you write it to end the show after 6 episodes in case it didn't go over? We started, and the show didn't go off for 28 years.
28 years.
Yes. Summer and winter, with no vacations. I mean, we would write people out of the show, but I mean, the show was continuous week after week. I think a president once in a while broke in on us, but aside from that,
a great career in pioneering, establishing concepts and precepts in radio, this wonderful broadcast medium. And Michael, Raffetto, Paul, you played many characters other than that alone. Can't you recall some of them now?
And Mike, the show that you wrote, I've been trying to think of it, the attorneys.
Yes, when I came to NBC in 1930, I came up with a script called The Arm of the Law, which I wrote and played the attorney. And it was a defense attorney, interestingly enough, this sort of thing now is so popular with all the lawyer series.
Yes, in television there's one of the great shows. Is that same general idea?
Yes, the Perry Mason and
that's right.
The new one that's on now, The Defenders.
The Defenders,
so
yeah.
On.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was the way I got into radio at NBC.
You came to NBC then as a writer, writing that series, didn't
that's
you?
That's right. That's the way I started with NBC, with this series.
You know, it occurs to me also, a reminder, Carlton, whereas it is true that you wrote the greatest radio drama as regards the family life, you also wrote great mysteries. Can't you tell us, remind us of some of those mysteries?
Yeah. Well, I just said I've got. I wrote The Family because I got fed up with mysteries. I started I Love a Mystery because I got so fed up with the sweetness and light of One Man's Family. I needed something. I needed a something to play against, and out of this. Came the I Love a Mystery series. Not that I didn't enjoy both type of things. But when you go along in a straight line, doing the same thing, and thinking in the same general category week after week, your brain gets a little fagged. And if you can do something to give you a complete turnover, it's an inspiration. It helps you do the other show.
What about that wonderful story of the Cambodian jungle? You remember that one? Angkor Wat?
Yes, that was part
Mike
of
was in that.
Yeah, oh yes, and he was in a number of them. I just saw his name here, Dr. Kuhn, in one of the mystery serials. Those were in the early ones before One Man's Family. Yeah. Let's see, the first thing I came here in September of 1929 to write The House of Myths was the first thing I wrote.
This was based on Greek mythology,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it was a modernization of Greek mythology. Then I wrote the Jack and Ethel Associated Oil program. Then came the mystery series. And One Man's Family and Slices of Life and...
Witch of Endor?
Yeah, they all...
English countryside stuff?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Great.
Yeah. And as I say, the members of One Man's Family were selected out of the groups that I played with in the other shows. So I knew all these people before the show started.
Well, personally, I feel it's just marvelous that we could sit here and reminisce regarding the days of 30 years ago and even more than that in radio on this station celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Now, will we all be back here in 40 years?
We will come back and say congratulations again in 40 years.
Mike, what do you say to that?
I'm sure we will, the way I feel today.
We have a rendezvous.
Good.
Very good. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.